All right, we're ready for John 9 and 10. We have some ground to cover. John has 21 chapters and we have 17 weeks, so you do the math and that means we have to combine something together. So here we go, chapters 9 and 10. Next week we'll have chapter 11 as a standalone chapter, and there'll be other times we have to group again. This is the outline that we're following. We borrow from Baxter. We are in the first major section of the book as Jesus' public ministry to the Jews. And we're in the second subsection, which has to do with witnesses and conflicts. Jesus gives the signs. There is a conflict with the Pharisees. And we see that time and again. We see that even in chapters 9 and 10. 9 and 10 do go together. Chapter 10 obviously follows on the heels of chapter 9. And we'll see some evidence of that as we get there. Let's review where we've been in our chapters. Chapter 1 was, He is the true light. Chapter 2, His power and His authority. Chapter 3, Teacher come from God. Nicodemus said that. Chapter 4, testimony to the Samaritans and the Galileans. And so here's that message spreading forth from the very beginning. Chapter 5, witnesses for Christ. And so this has to do with His giving His own testimony as to who He was, and then here are other evidences of that. Chapter 6, He's the bread of life. Chapter 7, controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacles. We may flag that just a little bit later. And then chapter 8, last time, He's the light of the world that deals with a dark nation. And so chapter 8 ends on them getting ready to take up stones and stone Him, and the text says, and He so passed by. Well, we come to chapter 9. We'll flag that passing by in just a moment. What's the main point of chapter 9? Question 1. All right, the blind see and the seeing are blinded. Where do we get that concept? Verse 39. Verse 39, Jesus said, for judgment I came into the world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may be made blind. We'll explain what that means in a moment. So the blind see and the seeing are blinded. That is, the blind man, physically blind, gained his sight. And so the blind end up seeing. Those who accept that miracle were spiritually blind and now see. But those Pharisees in the context could physically see and thought they could spiritually see, but they are blinded. And thus they're in sin, and that ends the chapter at verse 41. Make sense? All right. With that in mind, let's get underway. Here's what happens in chapter 9. There's the miracle in verses 1 to 7. There is the reaction, verses 8 through 34, and the conclusions that the blind man, formerly blind man, made about Jesus and that Jesus made about the Pharisees. Two different conclusions found in verses 35 to 41. So let's start at verse 1. That verse 1 starts on the same wording that chapter 8 closed on, and He so passed by. And as Jesus passed by, He saw a man who was blind from birth. Is there a direct connection? Maybe. We don't know how much time may have passed. It may have been quite closely connected. I think the phrase in pass by is simply suggesting Jesus is passing through the crowd, at times unnoticed, and other times He's noticed. But He escaped and He passed by, the text says. I don't think the text is implying immediately that in that same exit He come across this blind man. May have, but the text doesn't reveal that for us. But I want to pay attention to this miracle here, and let's start with the blind man himself in verses 1 to 5. The text says, Jesus passed by and He saw a man who was blind from his birth. There are numerous miracles through the New Testament concerning blind men being healed. To my knowledge, this is the only one where a man was healed who was blind, who said to be blind from birth. Others may have been, but they're not identified that I know of. Now, you may can correct me on that, but I think that's right. You can check me on that and see. Anyway, the disciples, what's the reason for his blindness? Or let me word it this way. Let's go to our questions. Question number three. What concept or view about sin was expressed in the question that was asked at verse 2? All right. It was implied by the disciples that there must be somebody's sin that caused this. And so was it this man or was it his parents? So it's based on a fallacious concept that says that while it is true that physical problems in the world are introduced because sin was introduced into the world from the beginning, that is, people die because of sin, there's disease because of sin, there was a fallacious concept that said that if you have a physical problem, it must be because you did something wrong. There's a book in the Bible that is devoted entirely to that question. What is it? Job. Job dispels that idea. That is the book of Job. His friends kept saying, you did something wrong. You're suffering, therefore you did wrong. And the book displays that's not the case at all. He was a righteous man. So away with that idea. Luke 13 is another passage we might flag that in verses 1 to 5 where Jesus dispels that idea. Do you think these were worse sinners? Remember that? And except you repent, you'll all likewise perish. He's dealing with the same concept. And so we have in the same concept here, in the minds of the disciples. And they were wrong about that. So in interest of time, I want you to notice at verse 2 and 3, Jesus says that it wasn't his parents' sin that caused this. And it wasn't his sin that caused this. But what did he say? Now, what does he mean by that? But that the works of God should be revealed in him. And then he talks about, I must work while it's day. Night is coming, no man shall work. What's his point? All right, that's true. I don't think he's saying by this that God caused him to be blind for the purpose that God could display his power. But in that the man was born blind, God uses that as an occasion to display his power. Does that make sense? Let me give you a passage that may be parallel in principle. Let's go over to Romans 11. This ought to be familiar because we just came through Romans 11 in our Sunday night series. And notice at verse 32, for God committed them all to disobedience. In other words, that he's talking about the Jews and Gentiles. The same principle is true concerning Jews and Gentiles. God committed them to disobedience that he might have grace on all. So did God cause them to be in sin so he could have grace? No. They chose to be in sin, and God used that as an occasion to display his grace. See the difference? And I think that's what he's saying here. Now at verse 5 of our text, he said, I am, as long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. That's interesting in this context because he just said something about that in chapter 8. Remember that? The light of the world shines in the dark to a dark nation. But he's going to bring light to the eyes of the man who was blind, and he can bring spiritual light to those who are spiritually blind. But they're going to close their eyes, as we see at verse 41. Make sense? All right. So we have here the situation of the blind man. Let's talk about the miracle or the healing. What did Jesus do at verse 6? All right. He spat on the ground, made clay out of the saliva, put it on his eyes, and then told him to go wash at the pool of Siloam. Siloam means sent, and it may have reference to the fact that the water has come from higher sources, and it was sent down, and thus there is a play on the concept that the man's healing is coming down from above. Does that make sense? So you go wash in the pool of Siloam. Well, where is the pool of Siloam? This is the city of Jerusalem about the time of Christ. Right there in the circle is the pool of Siloam. No significance of the water being different there than the water anywhere else. But he told him to go dip in the pool of Siloam and he'd see. Do you think there was any healing power in the clay? Think there was any healing power in the water? All he's doing, finish my sentence, all the man who is blind is doing is following in obedience. Do you remember the case in 2 Kings chapter 5? Go wash in the river of Jordan and be cleansed of your leprosy. Any power in the water? No. Is that the way you cleanse leprosy? No, it was simply following the direction of God. And the same thing is true with reference to commands that God gives us in our present day. Now, verse 7b, what happens to the man? Yeah, can you imagine? No description is given in this context of the reaction of the man, but can you imagine his reaction? He's never seen a thing in his life, and suddenly he sees everything clearly. Not that he has some vision, he sees everything clearly because this was a miracle of God. He comes back seeing, he can see Jesus, he can see everything going on, he can see the disciples, he can see where Jesus is. No description is given concerning that, but that must have been fascinating. And so he came back seeing according to verse 7b. All right, that's the miracle. Now that's going to cause some problems, so let's go to verses 8 through 34. Let's talk about the reaction. There are some who are described here as the neighbors. They must be Jews. They don't seem to be the antagonistic Pharisees. Now, are they Pharisees? They very well may be. I'm not just saying they're not Pharisees. But I'm saying that they don't seem to be that leading class, that ruling class of the Pharisees that we come in contact with at verse 13. So they are neighbors. They're people who knew him. So what's the reaction now? All right, there's some confusion. Is this the man who sat and begged? I'm not sure about this. Some commentators make a point that they speak with disdain about this man because of this word that's used right here. Let me find the word I'm looking for. Verse 8. Is this the man that was blind? This is a textual issue between the majority-minority text. The minority text uses the word beggar. And this majority text, let me get that right, uses the word blind. So it's a textual issue. It's not a big issue, but it's a little textual variation between the Greek text. And because of that minority view, some have concluded that this was a statement of disdain, that they have no regard for him. He's a nuisance. Maybe so. I'll leave that for you to decide. I'm not sure that that's a conclusion I have to draw from that. So some said that it is him. Others said he looks like him. But the man that had been healed said, it's me. I am. Yeah, I'm that one that was sitting over here begging. And it's me. So that's the reaction of the neighbors. They ask who he was. Then they ask him another question at verse 10. How were your eyes opened? And he said, there's this man named Jesus. He did it. He put clay in my eyes and he told me to go wash. And I went and I came back and I'm seeing. Now let's think about this. The point of verses 8 through 12 is to establish the healing as a fact, not a rumor of a healing. But it established as a fact. So the neighbors who knew him said, I think that's the same guy we've been seeing begging over here that was blind. Since his birth, he's been blind. We know that guy. And is he? No, I don't think he just looks like him. And he said, no, I'm that one. It's establishing it as a fact. And so the question, it was how, not whether he was healed. They asked the question, how did he open your eyes? Do you see the difference? They didn't ask, have your eyes been open? Has there been a mirror? Has something changed? Are you able to see now? They admit he's able to see. The big question is, how did this happen? How on earth did this happen? And that's going to be the question, and it's going to shift again here in a moment. All right, so then they ask him, verse 12, where is he? In other words, they want to go look for him and find him. So let's talk about the Pharisees. Now we move to the ruling class. Why did they come to the Pharisees? Verse 13. Verse 13 and 14. Say again. Convinced there's a miracle. It was on the Sabbath. So they admit a miracle, number one, but it's on the Sabbath, and we need to report this to the ruling class. Well, they're trying to trick him, but they got to report him to the ruling class, because the big deal now is, as always, it was done on the Sabbath day. This man must have violated the Sabbath. Ignore the miracle. Ignore the power. Ignore the change. Don't rejoice with the man over his seeing. We've got a man who's violated the Sabbath, we think. And so we got to take him to the Pharisees. And so beginning at verse 15 now, what happens? What'd they ask? How did you receive your sight? They don't deny that he's received his sight. They don't deny a miracle has been performed. They're saying, how did you receive your sight? Now, let's talk about the response they made to that. Well, and what was his answer? Yeah, same thing. Told the same thing he did before. He put up clay in my eyes and told me to wash, and now I see. So it's a simple story. It was this man, Jesus. He told me what to do. I went and did it. Now I come back and I'm seeing. There's your answer. Now, verse 16. What was their response to that? Yeah, no, he's not from God. Mm-mm. That couldn't be the case. Yeah, because he didn't keep the Sabbath. And others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And now there's division among them. How can a man heal a man and yet be violating the Sabbath? How could that be? How could he have this power from God and still violate the Sabbath? No, he violated the Sabbath. And they said, I'm going to wait about verse 17 in a moment. So this division is and tension is beginning to build. So we have the reaction of the neighbors and the Pharisees. Then we have the reaction of another person. And that's the man who's been healed. You notice I take verse 17 and then drop to verse 24 and skip verses 18 to 23 because that deals with the reaction of his parents. We'll come back to that. We're not ignoring it. We're going to come back. Let's talk about the healed man. What did he say? He concluded, yeah, he's a prophet. So what do you say about him that opened your eyes? All right, you want to know what I think? He's a prophet. In other words, he's from God. He has some special relationship with God. That's what I say. Now, verse 18 beginning, they begin to ask some questions, and then he gives an answer to that. So this is quite interesting. Verse 20, let's drop down to verse 24. We'll get back to verse 18 to 23. Let's drop down to verse 24. They come again to the man who was blind, and they said, give glory to God. That is a phrase, and you might flag Joshua 7 and 19. That's a phrase that was assuring the truth is going to be told. In other words, it's not exactly an oath, but it's like raise your right hand and give glory to God and tell the truth. Does that make sense? We want to hear the truth of the matter. No fooling around about this. We want to know exactly what's going on here, young man. And so give glory to God. We know this, that this man is a sinner. How did he react? Verse 25. Yeah. I don't want to get into this theological question. This is the man speaking. I'm not interested, though he does, getting into your theological discussion of whether he's a sinner or not. But I'll tell you one thing I do know. I was blind and now I see. You might underline that passage. That is a powerful passage. There are times that I have to tell people, I don't know everything there is to know, but there is one thing I do know. Something I can drive a peg on. When I was young, before I had children, as a preacher of the gospel, I needed to preach on rearing children. Because you got to preach the whole council, don't you? And you know what the reaction of older people would be to a 20-year-old? What do you know about raising children? So you know what I'd tell them? I don't know much about raising children, but one thing I do know. God said, and I'd quote the text, and they couldn't argue with that. No. One thing I know, here's what God said. And on with other subjects, same thing. Powerful passage. He said, y'all can get into that discussion about him being a sinner, but one thing I know that you can't dispute, I was blind and now I see. So verse 26, now I love what happens here. Verse 26, They said, yeah, what did he do and how did he do it? And his response was, I've already told you. This is the third time, really, he's explained it. I told you, he put clay in my eyes, told me to watch, go to the pool of Siloam. I told you, put clay in my eyes, and told me to go to the pool of Siloam. You're asking me the third time, he put clay in my eyes, and he told me to go to the pool of Siloam, and that's what I did. And then he gigs them. You think they deserved it? Absolutely. What? How'd he gig them? Yeah. Why do you keep asking? Are you wanting to be his disciple? Yeah, I have a lot of interest in him. Do you want to be his disciple? Why are you so interested? And boy, that set the house on fire. And they said, you are his disciple. We're Moses' disciple. That's a charge. You yourself, young man who's been healed of his blindness, are an apostate from Moses, as well as Jesus. And we'll get to that in a moment. And so we know, verse 29, here we are. They said, we know where Moses was from, but what's the charge now? We don't know where he's from. And so now, verse 30, he comes back even stronger. He got drawn into this theological discussion, whether he wanted to be or not. And so he says now, what? Verse 30. It's an amazing thing. I am absolutely marveling that you don't know where he's from. Look at verse 30. Why is this a marvelous thing that you do not know where he's from and yet he's opened my eyes? I mean, how hard is this to figure out? He opened my eyes and you don't know where he's from? So he argues in syllogistic form. Major premise, minor premise, and conclusion. So let's look at his major premise. Verse 31. We know that God does not hear sinners. Let's stop and footnote there for a minute. He didn't say, I think or I feel, but he said, we know. How does he know that? There's a question about that. What is that? Question number. Somebody help me out. What question am I looking for? Number five. Yeah, four. Yes, verse four. You're right. How did he say we know? On what basis would he say we know? All right, Psalm 66 would be one. Proverbs 28 and 9. Psalm 34. Isaiah what? 115, Isaiah 59, 1, numerous passages. I'm not looking for an exhaustive list, but these are many passages that talk about God not listening to sinners. Their prayers are abomination, etc. Proverbs 28, Isaiah 59, God is separated from those who sin, etc. So how do we know that? Because of Old Testament revelation, we know that God doesn't hear sinners. But if any man is a worshiper of God and does his will, God hears him. So we know that. It's a minor premise, verse 32. What's he say at the minor premise? Never happened before. It's unheard of that a man can heal a man who is born blind. Now we know God doesn't hear sinners. God heard him. Conclusion, verse 33. What's his conclusion? Yeah, he has to be from God. You see how he argued? Here's a major premise. God, we know God doesn't hear sinners. You know that. You Pharisees know that. God heard him, therefore he is of God. Bingo. You wanted to get in a theological discussion? I didn't want to get into that with you. Here we go. And he did. Now, verse 34, what'd they do? They threw him out. Some argue, McGarvey, I think, argues this, and I didn't go back and check on this, but I think I've been told McGarvey says he was excommunicated completely. I don't think that. King and Woods both argue against that, that it's not an excommunication. It's just they cast him out of their presence. Just get out of here. You are unworthy of, like, we can't answer your arguments, basically is what that says. And so you get on out of here, and so he goes. I'll leave that for you to decide. All right, let's move on to the conclusion because we've got to get to chapter 10 here in a minute, see what we can do. The parents, they come to the parents. Now, verses 18 to 23, their purpose in talking to the parents was what? They're questioning whether or not he was really blind to start with. And so maybe this was just all a fake anyway. And so that's the purpose in coming to the parents. So they ask two questions of the parents in verse 19. Is this your son that was born blind? And how does he see? And they said, in answer to the first one, that's him. Yep. Secondly, ask him yourself. Yeah. This was our son, verse 20. How it was done, we do not know. Verse 21b, you ask him. It seemed like they're diverting a little bit. Some suggest that, notice at verse 22, that they were concerned at verse 22. The reason they answered as they did, because they feared the Jews that they'd be cast out of the synagogue. They lose synagogue privileges. That's the idea. Not that they're in the synagogue as the discussion is going, but they'd be forbidden from the synagogue. They lose synagogue privileges. And so they had rather subject their son to that danger than face it themselves. That doesn't say much about his parents, does it? That let him have that discussion with you. We don't want to have that discussion with you because we don't want to be cast out of the synagogue. We don't want to lose our synagogue privileges. He might lose them, but we're willing to do that. That doesn't say much for them, does it? They're lacking courage, obviously. Now, let's start at verse, that gets us down through verse 23. Let's go to verse 35 to 41. There are two conclusions that are drawn. The healed man drew a conclusion about Jesus. What was it? He must come from God. Jesus comes to him. This is a powerful verse, by the way. Verse 35. 35 and 36. Jesus found him as he'd been cast out. Do you believe in the Son of God? And he said, well, who is he? He said, I that speak unto you am he. I am the Son of God. Well, if he made that claim, what evidence does he have of that claim? So he could believe that. Yeah, he was the one who had experienced the miracle. He saw and experienced a miracle, so he knows any claim that this Jesus makes must be true. You claim to be the Son of God, you must be. So he believed him to be the Son of God, and because he is the Son of God, he then did what? He worshiped him. He's worthy of worship. Jesus draws a conclusion about the Pharisees. Now, this is interesting, verse 39 to 41. Verse 39, he said, for judgment I have come to the world, that those who do not see may see, both physically and most importantly spiritually, and that those who see, think they see, may be blind. And some of the Pharisees, when they heard this, they said, are we blind also? What a dumb question to ask. And his answer, yeah, you sure are. Because you say, we see, therefore your sin remains. In other words, if you had admitted your spiritual blindness, I could help you see. But since you deny that, you are spiritually blind. And if you're spiritually blind, you're still in sin. So when we get through with the chapter, we have a man who was blind is now seeing. And we have some people who thought they were seeing are blinded. Does that make sense? Verse 39. Now, chapter 10 feeds off of that. We don't have time to go through our practical things right there. We may come back to that perhaps later. Let's talk about Jesus being the good shepherd. Based on verse 11, if you're underlining key passages, key phrases, I am the good shepherd. He's also the door of the sheep. We'll get both of those phrases. But we have the parable and its application and the Jews and their reaction to that. Now, does this have any bearing on the previous chapter? Absolutely. Absolutely. Based on how the Pharisees have been behaving, Jesus deals with that. And you say, how do you know that? Has some time passed? Perhaps some months have passed from that feast that we talked about, what was in chapter 7. And there's a feast here in the wintertime that's mentioned at verse 22 and 23. But verse 21 tells me the discussion centering around the sheep and the sheepfold has everything to do with Jesus being opening the eyes of the blind, chapter 9. Verse 21 is your key verse that laces it back and threads it with chapter 9. Make sense? All right. With that in mind, let's talk about the parable and its application. So we're going to pick our pace up a little bit to get through with this chapter. We have the parable in verses 1 to 6. It is a parable of a sheepfold. This is a modern view of some ancient, modern picture of an ancient sheepfold in the Mideast. Here's how a sheepfold would work. The shepherds would bring their sheep there at night. They would count the sheep as they entered, and that, thus when we have the references like Luke 15, that he has 99 and he's lost one and he goes and seeks for the one, they then look for the lost. They would commit the sheep to the care of the porter or the doorkeeper, and at sunrise they come back to the door and they call their sheep. And in some cases they'd call each sheep by name, as we would our domesticated or docile animals, and call for the sheep, and they know of his voice, and they come and follow him. All right, that's just a general view of the sheepfold. So let's talk about the parable. He talks about entering the sheepfold. So I'm going to kind of group some things together so we can make it through the chapter and see how it fits with chapter 9. That you enter the sheepfold, if one comes by a way of not coming through the door, he must be a thief. He's trying to steal the sheep. He's coming over the gate, or he's coming over the sides of the wall. And so he is, he's a thief or he's a robber. In contrast, one who comes by the door to get the sheep is the shepherd. Now notice it, verse 3, they know his voice, and he calls them by name, verse 3, and he leads them out. Now verse 4 and 5 talks about leading the sheep. They follow the shepherd. The sheep don't follow the stranger. They don't know his voice. So he talks about the sheepfold. All right? What he's doing is contrasting the Pharisees, who were hirelings, false teachers, and Jesus being the true shepherd who enters by the door. They're thieves and they're robbers. They're trying to lead you astray. That's the point. Now, at verse 6, this is a key verse. What about this parable that the Pharisees heard? They don't understand. Now, in other words, he's exposing the blindness of the corrupt leaders. Does that make sense? He's exposing that blindness that he flagged in chapter 9, 40 and 41. That they are those that come over the gate, come over the wall and try to steal. They are not the shepherds. And so I am the true shepherd, and they didn't understand that parable. Now let's make the application. There were two points he made. You might underline it verse 7 and at verse 11. His first application is, with the sheepfold, I am the door. And the second application was, I am the good shepherd. Let's talk about the door, verses 7 to 10. That suggests he's the only way. The only way to get into the sheepfold is through the door. I'm the only way to salvation. All others, look at verse 8. All others are thieves and robbers. Says the same thing at verse 10. That leads to destruction. So you follow after these Pharisees who are denying the miracle, chapter 9, they're thieves and robbers. They're leading you to destruction. I am the door. If you enter by the door, there are three things that happen. Look at verse 9. I am the door, and if anyone enters by me, he will be saved. He'll go in and out and find pasture. In other words, be spiritually blessed. And at verse 10, he's going to find life more abundantly. I think it describes remission of sins, spiritual blessings, and eternal life. Isn't that what we're looking for? Come through the door, you get those three things. Now then, verse 11 to 18, I'm the good shepherd. In what sense is he the good shepherd? Look at verse 11, 15, and 17, and 18. A good shepherd will do what for his sheep? Give his life for the sheep. He'll risk his life to save his sheep. The hireling does what? Verses 12 and 13. He runs away. Look at verse 12. Look at verse 12. When he sees the wolf coming, he leaves the sheep and he flees. And the hireling flees because he's a hireling and doesn't care about the sheep. He's gigging the Pharisees, saying they don't care about you. They didn't care about this man who was healed of his blindness, did they? All they cared about was using that as an occasion to get at Jesus. They didn't care about him at all. He said, that's why these you're like these hirelings. Look at verse 14 and 15. The good shepherd knows his sheep and known by them. That describes a happy relationship. And then he says, there is one shepherd and one fold. I think he's hinting at, he's not maintaining and preserving that Jewish system of the Pharisees. He's establishing a new system for all nations. So look at verse 16. Might make a margin note. It's talking about the Gentiles. I have other sheep that are not of this fold. Now, I meant to hit this right here. The Pharisees enter by the wrong way, lead people to enter the wrong way. Jesus is the door. He is the good shepherd. So what's the contrast? He's the door. They are the wrong way. He's the good shepherd. Their character is wrong. They are not good shepherds. And so chapter 10 is a contrast to chapter 9. Does that make sense? Is that misleading? All right, let's talk about the Jews and their reaction. We've got 2 or 3 minutes. Let's see if we... They made a charge. What was the charge? He has a demon. Now, there was division among them. Why? Verse 19. Some said he had a demon, and others said he was not. Some thought demons empowered miraculous to do miraculous works. Evidence of that is in Matthew 12, 24. By the power of Beelzebub, he cast them out, etc. But the division involved, some of them saying, can a demon open the eyes of the blind? You're charging him having a demon. I don't think he's got a demon. He wouldn't be doing these miracles if that's the case. And some said he does not have a demon because he opened the eyes. So there was that charge. Now look at verse 22. There's the Feast of Dedication. This is not in the Old Testament. So some time has passed since the last feast we've noticed. This is going to be late November, early December. We'll flag that in just a second. Antiochus Epiphanes, that wicked king of Syria, desecrated the temple and drove the priests from it. So during the Intertestament period, it was rebuilt and cleansed and dedicated. And this was a national holiday to commemorate that, like our 4th of July. It was a national celebration. This was not, so you're not going to find the Feast of the Dedication back in Leviticus. It's not there. This came about during the Intertestament period. And so it fell right here in this month, Kislev, which was late November, early December. So some time has passed since the Feast of the Tabernacles, which was the last feast flagged in the book of John. Does that make sense? Some time has passed. Maybe a couple of months have passed since then. So then they ask a question, how long will you leave us in doubt? Tell us plainly if you are the Christ. And what was his answer? I told you, you didn't accept it. I gave you evidence of miracles. And then it looks like he shifts gears. I and the Father are one. In other words, I think that's a conclusion he's drawing. The miracles tell you I'm from God and I am deity. I and the Father are one. Here's his conclusion to that. You ought to know who I am. How long do we leave you in doubt? No. I've given you plenty of evidence. There is no doubt that I and the Father are one. And then he concludes with, they made another attempt to stone him, and he had a confrontation. Why are you stoning me? For what? Which good work did you stone me? Oh, it's blasphemy. Now, we've got maybe 30 seconds, so let's flag a couple of things, and we're going to be done. Do you remember John 5, where we defined the Son of God? That is, the expression Son of God means to be equal with God. We have that again right here. Might underline it, verse 33, you make yourself God. You make yourself God. Then drop down to verse 35. He said, I am the Son of God. And draw a line between those. Those are synonymous phrases. He had claimed, I am the Son of God, and they didn't like it because they said, that means you make yourself God. To be the Son of God means he's deity. He's not just a child of God. It's an affirmation of his deity. And he quotes from Psalm 82, where the gods had reference to civil servants, civil authorities. If they could be called gods, who weren't God, by the text, then why couldn't one who has the power that I have be called the Son of God? That was his argument that he makes. And so then there was the acceptance. Many believed, according to 40 to 42. Make sense? I know that's a hurried look at chapter 10, but I wanted you to see how it relates to chapter 9. We are done.